This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, critically acclaimed actress Vonnie Burrows reads from Sojourner Truth.
Ain't I a woman indeed? Well, now, women don't intend to fall into any more of your traps with Andrew Beck, attorney with the ACLU Reproductive Rights Project. Women fought to climb out of another trap dug for them on their long road for reproductive health and the control of their bodies. The deepest of traps, targeted regulation of abortion providers, known as TRAPS, laws that are cloaked in the deceptive language of women's health, but which actually put women at risk by shutting down health centers where women can get safe and legal abortions, was just argued at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court case was the most important abortion case in decades. Inside the court, the justices asked how the law will help Texas women. Meanwhile, outside, advocates gathered to demonstrate their support for abortion access for every woman in every state. Shifts in the power structure of Congress have led to promises to strip away access to reproductive health care, especially abortion.
Laws that make it difficult and not impossible for a woman to get an abortion if she needs one, particularly if she's poor, are increasing at an alarming pace. At this critical time, we'll reveal who's behind the traps and what we can expect from the Supreme Court in the wake of this latest anti-abortion case. And most importantly, on protecting access to affordable contraception, protecting a woman's ability to make a personal, private decision about pregnancy and abortion, and fighting pregnancy discrimination.
Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's begin with the Supreme Court. The TRAP, the Targeted Regulation of Abortion Providers, who was behind that saw this case progress to the Supreme Court? And how do you analyze the nature of the arguments that ensued and what you think they portend for women's reproductive health self-determination?
The first thing to remember is who is not behind these laws, and that is major medical associations and doctors. From the American Medical Association to the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, every mainstream medical association has come out against these laws and said they have nothing to do with protecting women's health, and in fact, they are going to harm women if they are allowed to go into effect. The short answer to who is behind the laws is politicians. Politicians in states like Texas, but well beyond Texas as well, playing doctor, writing regulations that are designed to close abortion clinics but are masked in the language of women's health. The ideas are generated by anti-abortion think tanks in Washington, D.C., like the Americans United for Life and the National Right to Life Committee, that writes draft legislation and sends it all across the country to politicians like those in Texas and Alabama and Wisconsin and other states that have enacted cookie-cutter versions of these laws. The laws have nothing to do with protecting women's health. That's crystal clear. They are instead all about closing down abortion clinics. That brings us to the other part of your question, which is how did that play out in the Supreme Court? For those of us who care about a woman's ability to access safe and legal abortion, there were definitely some heartening moments in the court because the justices really seemed to get the idea that these laws have nothing to do with protecting women seeking an abortion, which is already one of the safest medical procedures a woman can seek in Western medicine, and is instead all about singling out abortion for unnecessary and onerous restrictions that are designed to have the effect of closing down abortion clinics. So you saw a lot of questions from the justices indicating, why have you singled out abortion here when we know, for example, that colonoscopy has a 30 times higher risk of complications? Why did you single out abortion? You can get a procedure in a dental office, has a far higher risk of complications. Yet again, the politicians have, with sort of a laser-like focus, singled out only abortion. And that really got under the skin of some of the justices, and you could tell in some of their questions. So for those of us who are concerned about these issues, there was a lot of optimism to take out of the argument from some of the justices' questions.
Could you go a little deeper in what exactly the Texas case was? What did Texas do to discourage abortion?
The Texas law has two parts. It falls under the category of trap laws, which are targeted regulations of abortion providers. Those are laws that single out abortion providers for unique restrictions, invoking sort of the rationale of women's health, even though they have nothing to do with women's health. And they single out abortion providers, even though they don't impose comparable restrictions on physicians providing similar forms of health care. So the two provisions at issue in the Texas case are what's called an ambulatory surgical center law that requires abortion clinics to transform themselves into miniature hospitals that are designed. Ambulatory surgical centers are meant to provide spaces where physicians are performing much, much more complicated surgical procedures than an abortion. And so it's really sort of subjecting abortion clinics to restrictions that are designed for a much more serious type of medical procedure. That's one of the provisions at issue in this case. The other provision at issue in this case is an admitting privileges requirement, which requires doctors who perform abortions, but again, no other form of outpatient health care, to obtain privileges at a hospital, which, as the drafters of these laws well knew, abortion providers just can't get. So the result, predictably, is to close down clinics. So in Texas, if these provisions had been allowed to go into effect, it would have the effect of closing down something like 3/4 of the abortion clinics in the state and forcing women to have to drive hundreds of miles in order to obtain that form of health care, creating waiting lists, delaying what is obviously a time-sensitive procedure. So those are the two provisions that were at issue in the case. And again, the justices, many of their questions zeroed in on the fact that this is singling out abortion for very onerous regulations that are not imposed on any other kind of outpatient health care.
Does this mean that now, as per Justice Kennedy, that it will be sent back to the lower courts to come up with more of a factual predicate about whether or not it's speculative or whether or not there are actual closures that will occur as a result of this regulation? I mean, where did the court leave the argument?
You've hit the nail on the head in terms of zeroing in on Justice Kennedy. As with so many issues in the Supreme Court, this case turns on Justice Kennedy, at least reading the comments that the justices made at the argument. And as is often the case, it's difficult to read the tea leaves in terms of an outcome based on the few questions that he asked. But he did ask questions that seemed to suggest that the lower court's approach, which was basically to say, so long as the state said this law was about women's health, it doesn't matter whether or not the evidence actually shows that to be true. And in fact, even though the evidence proves otherwise, if the state says it, we have to accept it. That was the lower court's approach. Some of Justice Kennedy's questions were not consistent with that lower court approach. And so one potential outcome would be to send it back to the lower courts to develop further facts. And another outcome would be to set a clear standard that rejects that lower court approach and that says when states pass laws restricting abortion in the name of protecting women's health, there has to be some evidence that shows that the restriction is actually about what the politicians have said it's about. You can't pass a law claiming to be about protecting women's health when, in fact, we know the law will, in fact, harm women.
Now, one of the things that happened in May is the House passed what we think is an unconstitutional 20-week abortion ban. Now the Senate is taking its turn, and thanks to the baseless attack campaign targeting Planned Parenthood, abortion opponents think they've kind of got momentum on their side, so it looks like they're gunning again to get a 20-week abortion ban passed as the first step in their push to end safe and legal abortion forever. Tell us about that effort and to what extent we're filled with trepidation that they really can turn the clock back for women.
I mean, that's exactly what this law would do if it were allowed to pass. And it's very important that it not pass because it would, in fact, turn back the clock.
As and by said, the way, we should say the bill is actually H.R. 36.
Correct. Again, the bill is singling out and targeting women and is patently unconstitutional. But it's also, in addition to that, incredibly insensitive to the very complicated circumstances of women who are seeking abortion. So we know that The vast majority of abortions in the United States takes place in the first trimester. But we also know that life is messy, and we never know all of a woman's circumstances, and there are many circumstances, including diagnosis of a fetal anomaly or incest or other circumstances to each individual woman's life, that cause some women to need abortion services at a time when this law would make that illegal. And we know that when abortion services aren't available, it doesn't mean that people don't obtain abortions. It means that they resort to unsafe measures. And so this is a really insensitive and very dangerous law. And we think it's very important that people take a stand, contact their legislators, and tell them how dissatisfied they are with politicians playing politics with medicine.
And what's happening with other states with regard to laws similar to the Texas law or other laws that seek to hinder women's right to have an abortion?
So there is a real onslaught at the state level. In the past 5 years, states have passed something like 290 restrictions on a woman's ability to access an abortion, which means that in the past 5 years, since 2010, states have passed nearly as many restrictions as they had in the prior 15 years combined. And in 2015 alone, states passed 60 new restrictions, and they have not let up in 2016. So the restrictions fall into a number of categories. Certainly, you know, I think at the top of the list is the trap laws similar to the Texas law we're seeing. So Texas obviously rightfully has been the focus of everyone's attention right now because it's the case before the Supreme Court. But there's litigation against comparable laws going on in six states right now. So in Alabama, Wisconsin, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee, there is ongoing litigation challenging similar laws. And all of those laws, like Texas, would have, if they were allowed to go into effect, have dramatic effects on access to abortion. But it's not just trap laws. We see laws banning abortion, whether it be at an early stage of gestation, for example, at 6 weeks, like North Dakota passed a couple years ago, or 12 weeks, like Arkansas passed, or the 20-week restriction that we were just speaking about. There are bans on abortion procedures. There are laws that are designed to shame women seeking abortion services by forcing them to wait 24 hours, 72 hours, because the implication is that they haven't thought long and hard enough already, and that they're supposed to make two trips to the abortion clinic and think a little harder before they're able to obtain health care. So those are some of the examples of the laws we're seeing introduced around the country. But it's a real onslaught that's really picked up ever since 2010.
And, of course, there's the issue of contraception that is certainly not faring very much better. And I want you to talk a bit about what is happening. We certainly are familiar with the Hobby Lobby case and what that meant for contraception for women. And after you do that, got to shift gears radically and talk about the fight back, lest I leave here in a state of abject depression and do fall into one of those many traps that have been set for us. And of course, there's splendid, remarkable work, because every one of the cases from Kentucky to Florida to Texas and so on to Maine, the ACLU has been on the case, as well as other organizations from the progressive legal community who do fight ceaselessly for women's reproductive health and self-determination. So we don't want people to leave here with too many pains, but we definitely want them to tell the Senate, the politicians who aren't medical experts and must not be allowed to interfere in a woman's medical decisions, to reject H.R. 36. But having said that, tell us a little bit about what's up on the contraceptive front and what we need to do to not fall into those traps.
Definitely. Starting with the contraceptive rule case, this is a case, sort of an extension of the Hobby Lobby case, but as everyone likely knows, the federal contraception rule is part of the Affordable Care Act. It was a regulation that was promulgated under the Affordable Care Act, and it requires health insurance coverage for a host of women's health issues, including domestic violence screening and prenatal care. And so as a result of the contraception rule, insurance plans have to include all FDA-approved contraception without a copay or deductible. And there is an accommodation in the law, which is what is now at issue in the new case called Zubik. Under the accommodation, if a religiously affiliated nonprofit has a religious objection to covering contraception, they're accommodated. The employer doesn't have to provide contraception or insurance that provides contraception. They simply have to fill out a form saying they object to it and send it to their insurance company or to the federal government. And what is at issue in this case is whether or not simply having to fill out that form amounts to a substantial burden on the religious exercise rights of these nonprofit corporations. The interesting thing with Hobby Lobby is Hobby Lobby looked to that accommodation and said, that's sort of the basis of the rationale that the Supreme Court used in ruling in favor of Hobby Lobby in the prior case. So it's a little ironic for the employers now to come back and say, no, that isn't good enough, and that imposing a substantial burden on our religious exercise. So that is the nature of the challenge before the court. It will be heard in the Supreme Court later this month. What this case is really about is discrimination against women, with employers trying to use religion to block their employees' coverage for contraceptive health care. So we will see how that plays out. But to transition to your final plea, which is, you know, what basis for optimism do we have here? I mean, I think this is, it's a challenging time, but it's also a very exciting time in the sense that I think a lot of folks are galvanized, and it's not just the organizations that have been fighting in court, but people who are watching the Supreme Court, seeing what's at stake with, you know, how far extreme politicians are going, I think people are galvanized by the attention that this is getting. And so you saw people, you know, for example, in the amicus briefs in the Supreme Court on the Texas case, you know, whether it was people in business or people, lawyers or other people in other walks of life, filing amicus briefs and saying, you know, what the lawyer's brief started out with a quote from a lawyer who said, I'm a lawyer who had an abortion, but I'm also a lawyer because I had an abortion, and really sort of speaking out on the importance of the ability to access safe and legal abortion and what that means for women's lives. And I think there is a sense, you know, I have to be an optimist to be able to work in this line of work, but I think this is a time when it is very exciting because you are seeing a sense that this is something that is resonating with people. It's important for folks to reach out to their congressmen and, frankly, their state politicians as well, because these laws are being passed at the state level. That's where the greatest number of restrictions are coming from. And I think this is a moment where we can really take advantage of the outrage that people feel over these sham charade laws that are passed purported, you know, for one reason. They, you know, the politicians say one thing, but we all know it's about something else. And I think that that's really getting under people's skin. And so I take from this sort of a positive moment where people are really galvanized and motivated.
Well, you've lifted my spirits. And of course, we understand that so much of this affects poor women, women of color. Thank you for your astute analysis, Andrew Beck, attorney with the ACLU Reproductive Rights Project, and a special good Women's History Month. Let's listen to Ann Feeney.
That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages, lifted over mud puddles, and have the best place everywhere. Ain't no man ever lifted me into carriages or helped me over mud puddles, and I ain't never had the best place anywhere. Ain't I a woman?
Woman.
Ain't I a woman?
Ain't I a woman?
Look at me.
In the town of Akron, Ohio, in the year 1851, an African-American woman delivered a moving speech at the Women's Convention that would be remembered for its rawness, its authenticity, and its powerful message that holds as much relevance today as it did then. Sojourner Truth spoke to the Women's Convention about her experiences and tribulations, not only as a woman in that day's society, but as a Black woman. She established a sense of identity as a victim of discrimination by describing how she faced prejudices as a black person and as a woman in order to incite an emotional response in her audience. And she invited that audience, mostly women, who experienced suffering from their own forms of discrimination, to realize the injustices of which they too are victims. And we're going to listen to actress Vinnie Burrows, who is going to be featured reading Sojourner Truth's Ain't I a Woman.
Thank you, all of you who are standing out there. And it is really wonderful to look around and see the young people, to see the older people, to see the local construction workers, local, their women's committee is out here in force. We should congratulate the Women's Day Coalition for putting together this event. We're here because on August the 26th, 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified and ostensibly gave women the right to vote. Well, a previous speaker talked about the omissions when it said women were given the right to vote, because it meant that black women, Native American women, were not given the right to vote. Congress ratified the women's right to vote because women struggled. Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without demand, without struggle. What we want, we have to struggle for. I want us today to also honor a woman warrior, a freedom fighter, African woman, Sojourner Truth. Let me hear it for Sojourner Truth. Say her name again. Once it was Sojourner's rage against the brutality of chattel slavery, against the oppression of women, that spurred what finally became the 19th Amendment. And it is in the spirit of Sojourner Truth which animates today our Black Lives Matter, our Give the Palestinians a State Matter, the End Police Terror Matter, End Fracking, Protect the Voting Rights Act. Let's call her name again once more out loud. She was born in Ulster County, New York State, near the end of the 18th century. She was the so-called property of Dutch settlers. She was given the name Isabella Bumfrey. When slavery was abolished in New York State, Isabella Bumfrey decided to get rid of her slave name. You see, Malcolm wasn't the first one to do it. And she took as her new name Sojourner, because she was going to sojourn, travel all over the United States, and she was going to speak out against slavery, and she was going to speak up for women's rights. And since she said everybody has a last name, she chose Truth, because she was going to preach the truth about the brutality, the inhumanity of slavery, and the oppression of women by men. Now I'm going to give you a speech that Sojourner gave at a women's rights convention in Akron, Ohio. She had not been invited to the convention, and when she got there, they didn't want her to speak, because the lady said, there is absolutely no connection between women's rights and slave rights. So Sojourner waited, seated in the auditorium, and when there was a lull in the proceedings, she got out of her seat, walked down the aisle, stepped up to the platform and said, well, children, where there's so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. Now, I think that twixt the colored people in the South and the women in the North, all shouting about their rights, the white man gonna be in a hell of a fix. pretty soon. But what all this here shouting about? Well, one man say women need to be lifted into carriages and helped over mud puddle and have the best place everywhere. Well, nobody ever lift me into a carriage or help me over a mud puddle or give me the best place anywhere. And ain't I a woman? Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could head me. I could work as much and eat as much as any man when I could get it, and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have birthed 5 children, and I seen all my children sold off into slavery. And when I cried out with a mother's grief, there was nobody, nobody but Jesus to hear me. Ain't I a woman? All right now. They talk about something in the head. What that they call it? Help me out, children. Intellect, that's it, honey. What intellect got to do with women's rights or colored folks' rights? If my cup don't hold but 1 pint and your cup hold 1 quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Now, the preacher man said that woman can't have as much rights as men because Christ want a man. Well, where your Christ come from? He come from God, and a woman, man had nothing to do with him. Now, if the first woman that God ever made was strong enough to turn the whole world upside down all by herself, then these women all together ought to be able to set it right side up again. And now they is asking to do it, the men had better let them. Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.